There was a monastery in Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka, which differs in opinion from those of the great monastery. So they held some views different than the views held by those of the great monastery. So now those people said that the ascetic practice does not belong to any of the three, does not belong to kusala or akusala or abhyagata or indeterminate. But the commentator or the Venerable Buddha Ghosa said, if it is so, then it must be a concept. And concept, according to Buddhism, is not reality, not paramattha. It is, concept is not reality. So if it is not reality, how can it be practiced? So we cannot accept their opinion. And also, if we take the ascetic practice to be concept, to be non-existing, then there will be contradiction with the word said by the Buddha, proceeded to undertake the ascetic qualities. So the ascetic practices should not be taken as panyati or as concept also. So ascetic practices are to be taken as either kusala or abhyagata. And then the explanation of the words ascetic practices, and those who talk about ascetic practices and so on, and they are not difficult to understand. A preacher of asceticism and so on. So some people practice themselves but do not encourage others to practice, and some people only encourage others to practice and do not practice themselves. And the examples are given here, like the Venerable Bakula, right? On paragraph 82, one who has shaken off his defilements with an ascetic practice but does not advise and instruct another in an ascetic practice, like the elder Bakula. So he practiced himself, but he did not encourage others to practice. And then the other one is Upananda. He encouraged others to practice, but he did not practice himself. And then the other one, who did not practice himself and who did not encourage others, like Lalu Dai. And the last one, yes, the Dhamma Senapati. What's that? General of the Dhamma. You know who? The general of the Dhamma. Sariputta. So Sariputta is always called in Pali Dhamma Senapati. General of the Dhamma. And Ananda is called the treasurer of the Dhamma. He is the keeper of the Dhamma. And then ascetic states. The five states that go with the volition of an ascetic practice, that is to say, fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, seclusion, and that specific quality are called ascetic states because of the words depending on fewness of wishes and so on. Now, I do not agree with the translation, that specific quality. The Pali word here is a strange word, but it means desire for these practices, desire for these wholesome states, not that specific quality, that it is desire to practice or desire for these wholesome states. So it is actually, it is knowledge. It is explained later in paragraph 84. That specific quality is knowledge. So by means of non-greed, a man shakes off greed for things that are forbidden. By means of non-delusion, that means knowledge, he shakes off the delusion that hides the dangers in those same things. And by means of non-greed, he shakes off indulgence and pleasures due to sense desires that occur under the heading of using what is allowed and so on. Now, 13 practices, and who can practice which? Oh, first, which is suitable for which person? So for one of greedy temperament and for one of deluded temperament. There are 6 temperaments. We will study them in the next chapter. So because the cultivation of ascetic practices is both a difficult progress, actually it means a difficult practice. It is not an easy thing to practice, to take up ascetic practices. So it is a difficult practice. And an abiding in effacement. And greed subsides with the difficult practice, while delusion is got rid of in those diligent by effacement. Now the cultivation of the forest dweller's practice and the tree dweller's practice here are suitable for one of hating temperament. That means also for one of hating temperament. For hate too subsides in one who dwells there without coming into conflict. He lives alone. He doesn't get to quarrel with any person. He might quarrel with himself. And then as to groups and also singly. And now 6 as to groups. These ascetic practices are in fact only 8. That is to say, 3 principal and 5 individual practices. The 3, namely, the house-to-house seeker's practice, the one-sessioner's practice, and the open-air dweller's practice, are principal practices. For one who keeps the house-to-house seeker's practice will keep the alms food eater's practice, and the bowl food eater's practice, and the later food refuser's practice will be well kept by one who keeps the one-sessioner's practice. So when one is taken, the others are virtually taken. And what need has one who keeps the open-air dweller's practice to keep the tree-root dweller's practice or the any-bed user's practice? So there are these 3 principal practices that together with the 5 individual practices, that is to say the forest dweller's practices and so on, come to 8 only. So 13 can be counted as 8 only when we take the principal ones. And then 2 concerned with robes, 5 concerned with alms food, and so on. But what is interesting or what is important is who can practice which practices. So singly, that is on page 83, paragraph 90. With 13 for bhikkhus, so monks can practice all 13 practices. 8 for bhikkhunis, the nuns can practice only 8. 12 for novices, samaniras, novices can practice 12. 7 for female probationers and female novices. There are 2 kinds of female female, I don't know what to say that, probationers and novices. If a woman or a girl wants to become a nun, then she must spend some time under probation, about 2 years, keeping only 6 precepts, and then she becomes a samanari, a novice, and then after that she becomes a nun, a bhikkhuni. So for such persons, 7 are allowable. And 2 for male and female lay followers. Lay people can also practice some of these practices, and there are 2 they can practice. So there are altogether 42. If there is a charnel ground in the open that complies with the forest dwellers' practice, one bhikkhu is able to put all the ascetic practices into effect simultaneously. So a monk can practice all the 13 practices if there is a charnel ground in the open and it is away from the village by about 1,000 yards. Then a monk living there can practice all these 13 practices simultaneously. But the two, namely the forest dwellers' practice and the later food refusers' practice, are forbidden to bhikkhunis by training precepts. Bhikkhunis do not have to keep those precepts, and so they cannot keep those ascetic practices. Bhikkhunis must not be on their own. They must live not too close, but they must live close to the monks, and so they cannot practice forest dwellers' practice. And it is hard for them to observe the 3, namely the open air dwellers' practice, the tree root dwellers' practice, and the charnel ground dwellers' practice, because a bhikkhuni is not allowed to live without a companion. So a bhikkhuni is not allowed to live alone. She must have a female companion. And it is hard to find a female companion with like desire for such a place. And even if available, she would not escape having to live in company. To keep the purpose in keeping these practices is to enjoy seclusion. And if you have to live with another person, then you lose that. This being so, the purpose of cultivating the ascetic practice would scarcely be served. It is because they are reduced by 5 owing to this inability to make use of certain of them that they are to be understood as 8 only for bhikkhunis. So bhikkhunis can practice 8 of them. Except for the triple robe wearers' practice, all the other 12, as stated, should be understood to be for novices. So novices, male novices, can practice 12 of them. Because novices cannot use the third rope, the double layer rope, and that is used by, or that is allowed for monks only. So samaniras or novices do not use the third rope, so they cannot practice the ascetic practice of having 3 ropes only. And all the other 7 for female probationers and female novices. So female probationers and female novices can practice 7 out of 8 for nuns. The 2, namely the one sessioner's practice and the bold food eater's practice, are proper for male and female lay followers to employ. So lay people can practice one sessioner's practice, eating at one sitting only, or the bowl food eater's practice, eating in one bowl only. So these 2 lay people can practice. In this way, there are 2 ascetic practices. So this is the commentary as to the groups and also singly. So these 13 practices are not much practiced nowadays. And those living in villages or in towns cannot practice most of these practices. But those who live in the forest monasteries can practice many of them. And there are still monks who practice many of them, like living in a cemetery or living under a tree and eating in one bowl and not lying down and keeping only three robes. And these practices are meant for effacement of mental defilements. We cannot do away with mental defilements altogether by these practices, but we can make them reduced. We can scrape them little by little by these practices. And so, according to the Visuddhimagga, a monk must first purify his moral conduct. A monk must have pure sila, and then he must practice some of these ascetic practices. And then next he will go on to practicing meditation. So these two chapters are for the basic practice before one goes to practice the calm meditation or insight meditation. Okay.
So next week we'll move on to concentration.
We go to concentration, yes. Very detailed instructions for the practice, or for taking up the practice of meditation.
Are those ascetic practices and the virtues and stuff, are those sort of absolute requirement to before you can, you know, go on to the concentration or the the next step is the basics. How important are they, and also in respect to the everyday people, and if you cannot do that, what is the relevance in that respect?
Purity of morals is absolutely necessary, because without the purity of morals, one cannot get concentration when he practices meditation. But the ascetic practices are just an extra practices. So even if you or a monk do not practice the ascetic practices, still it is possible for you or for that monk to practice meditation, provided that you have moral purity. So moral purity is a very necessary or is essential for the practice of meditation. That is because if there is no moral purity, then we suffer from remorse or from feelings of guilt. See, suppose my sila is not pure. So when my sila is not pure, I have this feeling of guilt. People think that I'm a good monk, but in fact I'm bad. And so when I try to practice meditation, this thinking comes to me again and again and torments me. And so when there is this feeling of guilt, there can be no happiness or no joy, and there can be no tranquility, no concentration, and so on. And in one of the suttas, the successive stages leading to the realization is given. And the first one is the moral purity. So moral purity helps us to be free from remorse. And the freedom from remorse promotes joy. And joy promotes happiness. Happiness promotes tranquility. And tranquility promotes another kind of comfort or happiness. And then the happiness of mind and body promotes samadhi and concentration. So in order to get concentration, we need some kind of comfort or happiness. Happiness in the sense of peacefulness. So moral purity is very important. But the ascetic practices are just an extra practices. And for lay people, it is not difficult to get moral purity, because even though their moral habits were not pure in the past, so before the practice of meditation, they can make up their mind that they will not break rules in the future, and they will keep their moral habits pure and take precepts, and then that's all there is to it. But for monks, it is not so easy, because they have to do there are some offenses which cannot be exonerated just by confession. Some require confession only, and some require confession and then giving up of the things involved in it. And then some require to stay for under probation for as long as one hides his own offense. Suppose I touch a woman with lusty thoughts. So, and that is an offense. And if I do not declare this offense to another monk, say for 10 days, then I must be under probation for 10 days. And if I cover it up for one month, then I must be under probation for 1 month, and so on. And then I need monks to assemble and do some kind of formal act to take me back into the fold of Sangha. So such offenses are not easy to get rid of. So for a monk, it is more difficult to get purity of morals than for lay people.
Is that because the lay precepts are fewer?
Lay precepts are fewer. Very yes. The minimum requirement for lay people is only 5 precepts: not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no intoxicants. So these are the 5. And some people may break one or two of these rules, but before the practice of meditation, that person really sincerely decides to refrain from breaking these rules in the future and to keep his moral conduct pure during meditation, then that's all right for him. So he is said to be pure in his moral habits. But a monk must do something more than just making up his mind or confession. So it is more difficult for a monk to get purity of morals than lay persons.
That doesn't make so much sense. That if a lay person can just make up his mind and then achieve peace of mind in meditation, why couldn't a monk just make up his mind?
Because a monk has broken the rule laid down by the Buddha. The 5 precepts are not laid down by the Buddha, but they are something like universal precepts. But the rules to be followed by monks are laid down by the Buddha. And so when I break a rule, I break the rule, and also I show some disrespect for the Buddha, for the one who laid down the rules. So there's a double, something like a double offense there. Breaking rule is one offense, and then disrespect for the Buddha is another. Two things. So monks have to get free from such offenses by following some procedure. Some offenses just by confessing to another monk, but some require something like being under probation for some days or some months. So it is more difficult for monks to be pure in morals than lay people.
And probation means?
That means first you must ask the Sangha to assemble, and then formally give you or formally recognize you as being under probation. And when you are under probation, you are not to enjoy being given respect by younger monks, and at the dining hall you have to sit at the end of a line, although you may be the eldest of the monks there. So something like that, a kind of punishment. And then at the end you need 20 monks to assemble to perform a formal act of Sangha, say to take you back into the fold of Sangha. So while under probation, you do not enjoy all the privilege of a monk. And you are not to accept respect from younger monks, and you are not to sleep under the same roof with another monk. So it is more difficult for a monk than a lay person to get purity of morals before the practice of meditation.
Brings up another question that you were mentioning in here about that concept, idea. Is that controversy or confusion arises because are there some kind of practices that might be similar to the ascetic practices? Which is done merely for the purpose of, for instance, attaining a certain type of power, or like psychic power, like magical powers, and so on. But the person who is doing those practices, which are similar to the ascetic practices, may not have the virtue and those in mind, and then practices to get sort of a worldly type of a power. Now that's very similar one, I think, and that might have confused this thing about between that and the ascetic practices that I mentioned here. Because by the definition already, if it is not done with the wholesomeness and so on, then it is not an ascetic practice anymore. So is there some practices like that?
I think the difference of opinion is whether the ascetic practices are to be included in the categories of wholesome, unwholesome, and neither wholesome nor unwholesome. And those people took ascetic practices to be just outside of these three, and so to them it is just a concept. So there is no reality to represent these practices, but in according to the opinion of the Visuddhimagga, and so opinion of common opinion of elders, the ascetic practice is reality, because when you practice, when you take up these practices, then you have the volition in your mind, and also the understanding or the knowledge of it. And so they are the units of reality, paramattha. But those other monks took the practice as to be just concepts, and so the argument from the side of Venerable Bodhisattva is, if they are concept, then concept has no existence of its own. It exists only in the mind's imagination, and so they cannot be realities. But the ascetic practices are or belong to reality, one of the four ultimate truths: the consciousness, mental factors, material properties, and nirvana. So ascetic practices are not concepts, but they are realities, and so they belong to either kusala, wholesome, or abhyagata, indeterminate. They cannot be unwholesome, and they cannot be outside of wholesome, unwholesome, and indeterminate either.
Are there practices that also, I mean, just from a historical aspect, that might have, where people do those type of, very similar to that, in order to attain some kind of a spiritual
type? Yeah, that's right. But they cannot be called ascetic practices, because they promote mental defilement, they promote greed, or some kind of attachment, and so on. Yeah. Okay.